This joint hearing of education policy reform and K-12 education finance will come to order. We are going to have the benefit of the Department of Education today to explain to us the flexibility plan that Minnesota has received. And I welcome to the table Kevin McHenry, who is their government relations person, and he will give some introductions, and then we will have an overview, members. And once the overview is completed, then we'll open it up for questions. Welcome, Mr. McHenry, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Kevin McHenry. I'm with the Department of Education. Just want to thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Garofalo for having this hearing. From the department, we are very excited about having our waiver approved. We have put some significant work into it. I know that there has been a chance to have hearings here. We've had several stakeholder meetings, and we've had several questions and back and forth, and we definitely appreciate all of the interest. We think this is something that's going to be a step in the right direction for how we're measuring our students as we are moving forward. I think what we're going to do today is I'm going to turn this over to Sam Kramer, who is our federal legislative specialist, and Jesse Montano, our deputy commissioner, to kind of go through what we have in place is a slideshow going through the waiver, and then we will be available for questions for other implications of other questions you may have. We also have some staff who have done some significant work on this, that if we need some details on further questions, we have them available. One thing I'd like to point out is that we did hand out it was an email to the commissioner from the U.S. Secretary of Education, Duncan, and so you can see that that's our approval of our waiver. A couple things I did want to point out. It states in the third paragraph, in particular, Minnesota has, you know, for this waiver, has demonstrated that it has college and career-ready expectations for all students, has developed and has a high-quality plan to implement a system of differentiated recognition, accountability, and support for all Title I districts and schools in the state. It's committed to developing, adopting, piloting, and implementing teacher and principal evaluation and support systems that support student achievement, and four, provided an assurance that it will evaluate and, based on that evaluation, revise its administrative requirements to reduce duplication and unnecessary burdens on districts and schools. So that letter will be in your packet among with others. So right now I'll turn that over to our Deputy Commissioner and Mr. Kramer.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry. Welcome to the table. Please say your names for the record and begin your PowerPoint.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jesse Montano, Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Education, and to my right.
I'm Sam Kramer, a Federal Education Policy Specialist at the Minnesota Department of Education.
And do you two have a joke for us this morning?
You don't want any jokes for me because I always mess up and give you the punchline first. So,
because I was just with the governor at the township breakfast, and he was telling us Ole and Lena jokes.
I do a horrible
That's how I started my morning. But welcome, and please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do an awful Ole and Lena. But I can do an Ocho, yeah. Nevertheless.
Yeah, sure. Why don't you begin?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Some of you have known me for a number of years and know that I have a history with Elementary Secondary Education Act, referred to as the No Child Left Behind, and the reauthorization that happened in 2002. So, you know, this is something very dear and near to my heart. I was involved in the reauthorization of ESEA when it became No Child Left Behind, and was involved in developing the accountability workbook that we have been using since then. And I can remember when it was being reauthorized, and we would get pieces of the law, and we would look, you know, the proposed legislation, and we would look and we'd say, oh, surely they must be kidding. Well, they weren't kidding. So in Minnesota, we did the best that we could with what we had. We had a stakeholder committee that helped us design the workbook. There are pieces in that legislation that throughout the years we have known have not worked. And we felt with this opportunity that here was a chance for us to make some changes to a process that While we learned a lot from that process, and there were some good things, there were some areas that needed to be fixed, and since reauthorization was not likely to happen, this was a wonderful opportunity for us. So we're very thankful for this opportunity, and we were very thankful for the opportunity to submit a waiver and also to present the substance of the waiver to you this morning. So with that, knowing that I do have this history, and that I think this is a fantastic opportunity for Minnesota schools and districts, I'm going to turn it over to Sam.
Madam Chair, what I'd like to do now is briefly go through a PowerPoint presentation that we've been giving for superintendents, and we gave this in the Senate a few weeks ago. Hopefully this provides an overview for members that allows you to understand what exactly we've been approved to do now. So I'll start with what stays the same. I think there's been a lot of perhaps misconceptions out there about what exactly we're keeping and what's being thrown out from the previous law. The first thing to keep in mind is that the academic standards in the state of Minnesota stay the same under the waiver. Nothing in the waiver allows us or encourages us to change our standards, to alter them in any way. The standards that were put into place in statute and then developed with stakeholders groups over the years, they remain in place, and in fact were one of the robustness of our standards was one of the reasons we were allowed to get this waiver in the first place. Our assessments also remain the same. Those assessments remain aligned to the academic standards we talked about previously. The number of students who have to take the test, the requirements for third through eighth grade and once in high school assessment remain the same. The limitations on the number of alternative assessments that can be allowed remains the same. Nothing in the assessment regime changes. The requirement for public reporting of data on schools remains the same. We still have to, again, using those assessments, report out data on school performance every year. We still calculate AYP. That's another misconception, I think. People think, well, AYP is gone now. It's not gone. It has been changed, and I'll get into more detail about that on the next slide, but we will continue to calculate and report AYP every year. And then finally, we will continue to disaggregate data by subgroup performance. This is something that I think many people have acknowledged at the 10-year anniversary of No Child Left Behind that has been a positive of the Act, and that's that we've now gone beyond looking at averages within schools or districts and or state and looking specifically at how's each subgroup performing. That continues under the waiver. So what do we get in the waiver? The first thing is that we get new AYP targets. As I said, we do maintain AYP. It's reported every year. But there are two significant changes, and they're kind of outlined in these first three bullets here. The first significant change is that the targets change. As you probably know, the AYP targets had previously been set on the goal of 100% proficiency by the year 2014. And as we approached that year, it became increasingly clear that those targets, while well-intentioned, were probably unrealistic for the vast majority, if not all, of schools. So the new targets that we've established reduce the achievement gap in half within 6 years. And the way we get to that is that we start with the statewide averages for each subgroup. So we now have individual subgroup targets that are established by those statewide averages. And over the course of 6 years, each of those subgroups is expected to reduce their non-proficiency by 50%. So a good illustration of this would be that if you have one group that's at 80% right now, 80% statewide proficiency, and another group that's at 50% statewide proficiency, you have a 30-point gap there. Over the course of the 6 years, the group that's at 80 will have to move to 90, cutting that non-proficiency in half. Similarly, that group that's at 50 will have to move to 75, also cutting their non-proficiency in half. So that gap has gone from 80-50, a 30-point gap, to 90-75, a 15-point gap. We know from looking at the data that this is a very ambitious goal. It's one that's going to be very difficult for most schools to meet, but we think that it's a worthy goal and one that is worth the effort on the part of schools and the state. The other change to AYP is that we eliminate the sanctions and financial set-asides for not making AYP. In the previous system, if a school didn't make, a Title I school didn't make AYP for 2 years or more, they had to set aside money for certain one-size-fits-all types of interventions within the school. This included school choice, supplemental educational services, corrective action, and eventually restructuring. There were some fairly, in the latter stages, fairly restrictive ways that schools had to change that worked in some schools and not so well in others. Under the waiver, those sanctions and financial set-asides are eliminated. We also have received greater flexibility both in the state and at the district level with our federal funds. At the district level, that is manifested mostly in the change from a 50% limit on transferability between certain federal funds up to 100% transferability. This will allow districts to better target their financial resources coming from the federal government to put it into programs that make the most sense for that school. And then finally, we have more flexibility in school improvement planning. This is probably the biggest change that we're seeing here, and that's that now, instead of, as I said, sort of these mandates on you have to do this specific intervention regardless of what your situation is as a school or a district, we have some flexibility in finding the right types of solutions for each school that's identified as needing some kind of improvement plan. And we'll get more into detail on that as we go through the slides here. So what is this new accountability system and what does it look like? The two goals that really are at the baseline and foundation of the new accountability system are the idea of closing the achievement gap and promoting high growth for all students. Closing the achievement gap, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. We know that as a state, we have one of the widest achievement gaps in the country. No Child Left Behind was pretty good at diagnosing that problem, but it didn't give us a very good prescription for addressing it. We think that with this new system that we have in place, that we can more aggressively and effectively attack the achievement gap and start to see some progress. And then the promoting high growth for all students refers to the phenomenon that we saw under No Child Left Behind with AYP of focusing on bubble students. The bubble students were those students who kind of hung right around that proficiency cut score, maybe were 3 points above proficiency in 1 year and there was risk that they were going to fall below the next year, or similarly students who were 3 or 4 points behind the cut score who there was a possibility that with focused instruction could move above that cut score. And we certainly want to encourage and incentivize work with those students, but we want to make sure that we're not focusing just on those kids within a classroom, because we know that we also have students at the other ends of the spectrum. We have students who are very high performing, who come in well above grade level. We have other students who come in some cases, several grade levels behind. And we want to be sure that we're promoting the growth of those students as well and building incentives into our system for that type of focused instruction on all students. The system is built around multiple measurements, moving beyond AYP, which was essentially a proficiency measurement, to look at 4 different measurements of school performance. We'll get into each of those measurements later on in the slides. We wanted to create incentives for high performance by, for the first time, looking at who are the high-performing schools, how can we recognize them, and what can we do to incentivize schools to strive to be one of those high-performing schools. We're going to directly address the achievement gap for the first time with interventions that are aimed specifically at the achievement gap and with a measurement that is aimed specifically at measuring the ability of schools to close that achievement gap. And then finally, we're going to provide support as a state through this Department of Education and our statewide system of support for locally developed school improvement plans. Again, allowing the state to go in and work with the schools and districts with local input on what makes the most sense for schools in terms of school improvement. So at the baseline of all of this new system is our multiple measurements rating. All schools in the state, regardless of their Title I status, are going to get a multiple measurements rating each year going forward. And the multiple measurements rating consists of 4 measurements. We have proficiency, student growth, achievement gap closure, and graduation rate. And these were selected in consultation with our stakeholders, and the 4 are really the product of a long conversation that's taken place over the last several years about what kinds of measurements really would show us how schools are doing and what's important to us as a state in terms of school progress. So I'll go through each of the measurements now individually. The first measurement is proficiency. And the proficiency domain uses the AYP index model that we've all gotten used to over the 10 years of NCLB. Schools earn points in the proficiency domain based on a weighted percentage of subgroups that make AYP. The way to look at this is that if a school has 10 subgroups, the way that they're going to earn points is by getting as many of those subgroups meeting their AYP targets as possible. We do weight those subgroups based on size, giving a slightly outsized weight to those subgroups that are even a little bit smaller. So if you have a subgroup that's 20 students compared to a subgroup that's maybe 100 students, that subgroup of 20 students is going to have more weight than it would if you just did a straight weighting system. So because, again, we want to focus on those smaller, sometimes underserved populations of students that are right now representing our achievement gap. Unlike in the AYP calculation, when we look at proficiency in this MMR domain, subgroups in schools don't make AYP through Safe Harbor. They have to hit their target. We've sort of had the joke around the department, and I think in districts too over the years, that there are sort of 100 ways to make AYP. You can make it through progress over a couple of years, which is Safe Harbor. You can make it through multi-year averaging. You can make it through growth. Some exceptions for special ed and English learner subgroup size. Under this proposal that has now been approved, in the proficiency domain, schools and subgroups only make AYP if they hit that target. And again, that target is based off this goal of closing the achievement gap in 6 years. So within the proficiency domain, we feel like we've built in that achievement gap goal in a strong way. The second domain that we're looking at in the multiple measurements rating is our growth measurement. And growth really builds off what we have in the Minnesota growth model. And it measures the ability of schools to get students to exceed predicted growth. Now you're probably wondering, how do you predict growth of for students? And the way we do that is the exact same methodology that's used under the Minnesota growth model, and that's to look at previous year scores to find an average for where students who were at a certain score point 1 year were the next year. For example, if a student in third grade averaged a 42, his growth expectation would be based off of what the students who scored 42 over the two previous years averaged in fourth grade. So if the average in fourth grade was 45 for all those students who had a 42 in third grade, then the expectation is that student will get to 45, and anything above that is going to represent a positive growth score. Similarly, anything below that is going to represent a negative growth score. This is the same methodology that's used in the Minnesota growth model. Each student is going to get a growth score like that, as I just outlined, and then each of those individual student growth scores is averaged together for a school growth score. So every school is going to have their own growth score, which is then given a percentile rank for all schools in the state, and that percentile rank helps to generate the number of points that they earn in this growth domain. The next domain builds off that same structure of growth measurements in the achievement gap reduction domain. And the achievement gap reduction domain really measures the ability of schools to get higher levels of growth out of those subgroups that we know are right now farther behind. So what we do is we measure the growth of lower performing subgroups within a school and compare it to the statewide averages of the higher performing students around the state. The seven subgroups that we have right now that currently have an achievement gap are our four subgroups of students of color. So we have black students, Asian students, Hispanic students, and American Indian students. We also have our free and reduced price lunch qualifier, so students in poverty. We have our special ed students, and we have our English learner students. Now these seven subgroups right now all have some type of achievement gap. It varies in size, but they're all behind where their counterparts are on average. So what we expect is that over time, those students are going to have to grow at a higher rate in order to close that achievement gap. And a metaphor that we've used to explain this is that right now we have all students lining up to run a race. And we have some students, for example, our white subgroup and our more affluent students, they're lining up at the starting line. They're 100 yards away from the finish, and they're lining up at the starting line. 20 yards behind them are the rest of those seven subgroups I just outlined. They're starting off farther behind, but they've got to get to the same place in the end, that 100-yard finish line. The only way that they're ever going to catch up and finish at the same time is if they run a lot faster over the course of the race. So what we're expecting in this achievement gap reduction domain is just that, that we're going to see higher levels of growth from the subgroups that are farther behind than the state averages for the subgroups that are farther ahead. What we've done to ensure that we're not closing the achievement gap by having lower levels of growth at the top end is that we've locked in these averages for the higher performing groups at a positive level. If they go down over time, the targets won't change. The targets will remain the same. If they improve, if the white students all of a sudden start growing at a higher rate or our affluent students start growing at a higher rate, the targets will be adjusted upward to set a higher standard for those groups that are farther behind. So the way that we ultimately measure this on the achievement gap reduction domain is that we subtract the school's growth score for those lower performing subgroups individually, each of the seven subgroups, from the statewide averages of their higher performing counterparts. And then a negative score would indicate success. If you think of it as a negative score, means you're chipping away, you've taken away from the achievement gap. That's what we're doing here in this achievement gap reduction domain. Finally, the fourth measurement will be just for high schools that graduate students, and that's our graduation rate domain. And this is going to use the same methodology that I outlined for the proficiency domain, which is that schools are going to get a score based off the percentage of subgroups that meet their AYP graduation rate target. Right now, the AYP graduation rate target is 85%, and it uses a methodology that that is frankly somewhat outdated. But moving forward next year, outside of the waiver, whether we had the waiver or not, we were going to have to transition into a cohort-adjusted graduation rate. So that's what we'll be moving forward with. So we'll have new targets, and we'll have a new methodology for calculating graduation rate. But for this first time that we run the multiple measurements rating in this spring, we'll have to use the old graduation rate targets, old graduation rate methodology. One thing that's significantly different about the way we're looking at graduation rate than what AYP did is that in AYP, you really just looked at the all students graduation rate. If you had a big school, you just had to make sure you hit that 85% mark. What we're looking at is subgroups, because we know if you look at the statistics in Minnesota that there are subgroups of students around the state that are graduating at an alarmingly low rate. We want to make sure that just as we're looking at an achievement gap with proficiency and growth, that we're looking at an achievement gap with graduation rates as well. And by looking at individual subgroup graduation rates, we believe that we're creating an incentive to really address that issue. Again, just similar to the proficiency area, groups only get credit for meeting their target. They don't get credit for year-to-year progress. While we certainly applaud year-to-year progress, and that is rewarded in the AYP measurement, it is not rewarded in the graduation rate domain, because we want to set a hard target that we expect schools to get to for graduation rate. So using those four domains, we generate a total multiple measurements rating, or MMR. Each domain is worth 25 points. The MMR is then generated by dividing the total number of points that were earned in each domain combined by the total number of points possible. For most elementary and middle schools, that's going to be 75 possible points because they don't have a graduation rate. And for most high schools, that's going to be 100 points possible because they do have a graduation rate. So doing that simple division will generate a percentage of points earned, and that's going to be a school's multiple measurements rating. So a school's multiple measurements rating is going to be somewhere between 0 and 100. And every school in the state is going to get this, again, starting this spring. Using that, we then identify Title I schools for recognition, accountability, and support. I think it's important to note before we go too deep into all of this that when we're talking about recognition, accountability, and support under the waiver, we're talking exclusively about Title I schools. And just to go to the foundational level of what we're talking about here, Title I schools are those schools that receive federal assistance because they have a certain level of poverty. You have roughly 845 schools in the state last year that received Title I funding that would then be considered Title I schools. So the percentage and the number of schools that we're identifying for recognition, accountability, and support will be based off that number of roughly 845. So using the multiple measurements rating, we're going to assign Title I schools to three categories. The first category is at the top end. The top 15% of Title I schools will be identified as reward schools. Again, this gets back to, I think, our third slide where we talked about incentivizing high performance. Under AYP, we really just had two distinctions. You made AYP or you didn't make AYP. There was no distinction between all those schools that made AYP and all those schools that didn't make AYP. Well, that's a pretty black and white system, and we know that within Minnesota there exist many shades of gray within our schools. The reward schools category is an opportunity for us to say, not only did you make AYP, but also you had high growth, you were working on closing your achievement gap in a good way, and you have high levels of graduation rates. So those reward schools are going to represent the sort of the best and the brightest of our Title I schools. And this, as I said, has two real benefits, we think. First, recognition, public recognition is an opportunity to incentivize high performance. That's something that we've heard from stakeholders throughout this process, is that they're very excited for the first time to be recognized for their good work instead of just looking at, again, making AYP or not making AYP. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, this gives us an opportunity as a state to, for the first time, really identify those high-performing schools and say, what's working in those schools? We know that we have a lot of great schools in Minnesota, but we haven't necessarily had a system for identifying those that are performing at the highest level. Now we do, then we'll be able to use that system to look at the best practices of these reward schools and then share those practices with the schools that aren't doing as well. Moving then to the lower end of things, I'll start with the third bullet here, and that's our priority schools. The priority schools are going to be the bottom 5% of Title I schools, roughly 45 schools. 19 of those 45 schools have already been identified because they're SIG schools, the School Improvement Grant Program that we have in Minnesota that comes from the federal government. Those 19 SIG schools are in the in their second year of their grant, of a three-year grant, so they'll continue to be SIG schools next year as the first year that priority schools are in place. Those 19 schools will be priority schools at least for next year. They will have an opportunity to exit after the first year if they show sufficient progress. The progress that we expect from those schools is very high. It's a high bar that we've set for schools to exit the status because we do believe that this process of turning a troubled school around is a long process. It's one that takes time and it takes a great deal of effort. And we want to make sure that we're not letting schools out of the status just because of perhaps one good year on the test. Priority schools are going to work with the Department of Education and our statewide system of support to develop turnaround plans for the school. Now, this is, again, going to sound pretty similar to what we have with SIG. The SIG schools have one of four turnaround models that were mandated through the program by the Department of Education. In our priority schools, they have to develop a turnaround model, but it doesn't have to be one of those four models. I think that comes as a relief to many districts and schools who found those four SIG models to be pretty stifling. There were some policy decisions that were forced upon them that were not necessarily in the best interest of the school or the district, and they've sort of struggled to overcome those over the course of their grant. Those types of decisions are not forced upon priority schools. However, those 26 priority schools or 27 priority schools, however many it is, that end up being new priority schools in addition to those six schools, are going to be expected to make dramatic changes to the way the school works. If you think of this in the context of AYP, it was really 6-7 years before a school got to the pre-restructuring or restructuring phase where they really looked at dramatic changes in the school. There is no such timeline under this system. Priority schools are expected on day one to begin looking at seriously changing the way that they operate. And this can take many forms, and in many ways it's just a complete change in the school culture that has to take place with a priority school. And the priority schools will be drawing upon, again, the resources of the Department of Education with interdivisional teams that can work on content with content specialists and things like that to improve curriculum. They'll also be working with the statewide system support, which has previously been known mostly through the service co-ops. In conjunction with the waiver, we have been looking at new models for providing support in the regions, and that's something that we're developing over time and that there will be more information about in the future. Then our final group, and the main three groups that we're dealing with here, is our focus schools group. And that's a number equivalent to 10% of Title I schools. And I want to be very clear that we're not talking about the next 10% up of Title I schools. It's not 5% is the bottom 5% is the priority schools, and the next 10% is focus schools. Focus schools have a very specific purpose, and that's, again, to attack that achievement gap head-on. Focus schools are identified exclusively because they are contributing to the state's achievement gap. So for focus schools, we're just going to look at the proficiency rates of the seven subgroups I identified in the achievement gap reduction domain, and then we're also going to look at that achievement gap reduction score. So schools that have low levels of proficiency and low levels of growth on those seven subgroups will be identified as focus schools. And those 10% of Title I schools, roughly 85 schools, will work again with the statewide system of support and MDE to develop a plan that's going to be specifically aimed at improving the performance of those subgroups. Now, in some cases, there will be multiple subgroups within the school at a focus school. Sometimes it's not just one subgroup that's struggling, but the whole school. So the plans may become more comprehensive than just looking at one subgroup. But the onus is on the school to really improve the performance of those low-performing subgroups for which they are identified. Focus schools will work more with their district on the implementation of these plans. The department and the statewide system of support are available for technical assistance and support throughout the three-year duration of their plan. However, the sort of hands-on day-to-day activities within the focus schools will be administered more by the district than by the Department of Education, and that's in many ways simply a matter of capacity. Again, I want to reiterate that the reward schools, those come every year. Every year that we release MMR, we'll be releasing a list of reward schools. However, those focus and priority schools, they stay on the list for 3 years. When we identify focus and priority schools in May, 2012-13 will be year one, 2013-14 will be year two, and 2014-15 will be year three. They do have an opportunity to exit if they show sufficient improvement, which represents, again, a major improvement of the school is the bar that we've set. But no schools are added throughout that time. Again, we want to be very efficient with our resources and direct them to those schools that are most in need of support. So a question that we've often got as we've presented this is, what about the other 70% of Title I schools? And furthermore, what about those non-Title I schools that are outside of the system altogether? The first thing that we say is that we are now going to annually report more data than we ever have before. The multiple measurement rating will represent the largest release of data on school performance that we've ever done as a state, including things like achievement gap reduction, which previously has not been reported, a growth measurement in addition to the Minnesota growth measurement, so just more information for parents about growth, and proficiency data as they've been used to with AYP. And then also a multiple measurements rating that all schools get, so it allows parents and community members to compare across schools and districts. We will continue to report AYP for both schools and districts going forward, as I outlined, now aligned to that six-year goal of closing the achievement gap by 50%. And then in an effort to really ensure that those schools in the middle don't just feel like they got off the hook, we've created two additional categories of schools beyond those three mandated categories I outlined on the previous slide. The first is our celebration schools, and again, this gets to the idea of incentivizing high performance. Celebration schools will come from a group of 25% of schools that fall right below the reward school designation, so schools between the 60th and 86th percentile of Title I schools. Within that group, there is an opportunity to apply to be a celebration school. These applications can reference things that go beyond the assessment data that we have, because while we feel like assessment data is very valuable and it's what we were asked to use by the Department of Education in our system, we do know that there are qualitative measures of school performance that are important as well. So a celebration school that's applying to be a celebration school would have the opportunity to talk about things like college placement statistics, what percentage of students go to college, what percentage of students are in advanced courses, AP, IB types of classes, PSEO participation. It could be something like an extremely successful arts program, music program, high social studies performance by students. It could be any number of things that go beyond the math and reading scores that we're mostly focusing on in our other schools. What we will then do is look at those applications and identify the equivalent of 10% of Title I schools as celebration schools. So you end up with 25% of schools identified at the top as high performing. Then with the bottom schools, every year we're going to identify continuous improvement schools, and these are going to be the bottom 25% of Title I schools. These continuous improvement schools will include some priority and focus schools, obviously, who are in that low-performing group, but will also include some schools that are not included in priority and focus school categories. The expectation for these schools is that they will develop with their district a school improvement plan that really gets to the core of what it is their issues are. Again, the statewide system of support is available for technical assistance on these types of plans, but we are not, as a department, going to mandate that they submit these plans to the department, that they be reviewed and approved. However, we will do an audit of 10% of continuous improvement schools to ensure that there is fidelity with the school improvement planning. So just to wrap it up, I know that this is a lot of information to take in, especially when we're talking about percentages of schools and Title I, non-Title I. But here's a visual way to show what we're doing with our Title I schools for the five groups that I've identified. The first is the top 15%, our reward schools up at the top. Then at the bottom, we have our bottom 5% of schools, our priority schools. Then falling somewhere in the middle are the schools that fall between reward and priority schools with the most extreme achievement gap issues, focus schools. The bottom 25% of schools are our continuous improvement schools. And then we have our celebration schools, which is 25%, 10% of which are selected to be celebration schools. So you essentially end up with 25% at the top, 25% at the bottom, with some additional focus schools that will probably fall somewhere in the middle, and then a new regime of data submissions every year that allow parents and community members to see how their schools are performing. With that, I'll turn it over to questions, but real briefly, I think we do want to make sure that the timelines are clear on this. We were approved last week now, a week ago today. We are now in the process of getting all the data together so that we can run the multiple measurements rating for the first time for all schools. That's going to take some time because of the quality assurance processes that are necessary to make sure that we've got all our I's dotted and T's crossed. So sometime in May, at this point we're just saying May, and we'll narrow it down as we get closer to that date, we will be releasing the list of priority focus and reward schools, as well as the multiple measurements rating for all schools in the state. And that will be based off of 2011 data, so data from last school year on the assessments and graduation rates, as well as the year before, because we do, for all of these measurements, use multiple years of data, which helps to control for small schools that have sometimes large variances year to year. So we'll be releasing that in May, and from that point forward, focus and priority schools can access the services of the statewide system of support and the Department of Education to develop their plans going into the next school year.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kramer. That was very well done, very, very well done.
Madam Chair.
Having been with you on occasion from the beginning, I think you have explained it very well to us and
how
this
will
play out. So thank you very much. Members, we're going to prepare for questions. And Ms. Montano, this might be a question for you, but you know, my focus is going to be on teacher quality to begin with. And as I read and studied your application beginning on page 104, and members, feel free, you know, to turn to these pages if I reference page numbers, or if any of you do. The fact that now in the priority schools, we can't have ineffective principals or ineffective teachers, and you have laid out in your plan that principals could be replaced, that you're going to have operational flexibility, that teachers that are ineffective, you know, I'm just not sure where you expect to go as a department with this. And then further on page 164, it sounds like you yourselves have taken on a review and approval option for teacher and principal evaluations. And I don't think any place in law we, you know, have given you that authority. So could you comment on, I know that's probably a very loaded question, but that keeps cropping up as I read and repeatedly read through your plan. So both what's said on 104 and 105 and 164. Ms. Montano?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, under the old, consequences or of not making AYP and the turnaround models, the options were either you replaced your teachers or you replaced your principals, and there were no ands or buts about it. If you're in Greater Minnesota, finding a principal is not an easy thing. So replacing the principal was a model that didn't work for us. Replacing all your teachers also is a model that didn't work for us. With this flexibility that we have the opportunity to go in and work with that principal towards better leadership skills and also work with those teachers. For those of you that are educators, you know that if you're going to change what is going on in your classroom, it isn't a matter of just somebody coming in and saying, you know, what you're doing isn't effective and here's what you have to do. You have to have ongoing support, and you've got to have coaching and mentoring, and it isn't just a one-time thing. It's over and over and over again until that you you acquire those skills. And the first time you hit a roadblock, you're going to go right back to what you're familiar with and comfortable with, even though it may not be as effective. So what this model allows us to do is look at those turnaround models that we were required to use before. I can give you an example. We had a school in northern Minnesota, where we had known for years that part of the problem was the principal and lack of leadership. And we kept encouraging the school and the district to replace that principal, and lo and behold, they finally found a top-notch principal. Well, then they became one of the six schools, and one of those models was replace your principal. It didn't matter, even though this was an absolutely fabulous principal. So he was replaced. They struggled to find another principal with equal skills, and I'm not sure they did, so I'm not going to name who this school is. This principal, in the meantime, went elsewhere and has done an absolutely fabulous job. What this flexibility is going to give us is the opportunity to work with teachers. In terms of looking at, connecting it to our teacher evaluation and how do you use that evaluation to really focus on what are the strengths and weaknesses of that teacher as well as the principal. And so this is a much better model for us in Minnesota, particularly if you are in Greater Minnesota where replacing half of your teachers is not likely to happen, particularly if you're looking at replacing them with quality teachers. We think a better way to approach this is to actually work with teachers, mentoring, coaching, doing the kinds of things that will be supportive as opposed to the stick.
Well, Ms. Montano, thank you for that answer. The principal evaluation will be piloted now this coming school year as all of this kicks in. You write in the narrative on 104 that MDE will require all priority schools to adopt an MDE-approved principal evaluation tool that will be utilized to review the performance of the current principal. So how's that going to play out, considering that, you know, they have been in charge of developing their evaluation? So, you know, by what authority now can you come in and control that? Mr. Creamer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think that when it says MDE approved, that would be more for next year. When the state's principal and teacher evaluation systems come on board in 2014, I believe, the expectation would be that those schools, priority schools and all other schools, would have their own principal and teacher evaluation model. I think the MDE approved teacher, the language in that particular passage that you read from, refers to the opportunity next year with the new priority schools that may not have a principal and teacher evaluation system in place is to work with those schools to develop one so that they can put it in place starting next year, not waiting for the statewide system to take effect in 2014-15.
I would argue, though, both of you, that if your plan here is to be effective in these priority schools, that you have to immediately have effective teachers and an effective principal. And I'm not sure how you can accomplish that without having evaluations in place and besides that, staying within the law that we passed that doesn't give you that authority. Ms. Montano.
Madam Chair, having effective principals and effective teachers immediately, what the intent really is, you can't just go in and say, here's what I see is wrong in what you're doing, and you're going to change it, and you're going to be effective right now. That's just not going to happen. We want effective immediately in terms of a process to get you there. We want to make sure that schools at least have a process and a mechanism by which to start evaluating teachers and principals and identifying the strengths, and then having the support system behind for us to help them put those support systems together. We want immediate change, absolutely. But we all know that change doesn't happen overnight. So the word effective means we need to start the process that's going to get us to effective. No change happens overnight, and we're well aware of that. But nevertheless, the goal is to have effective teachers and principals, leadership, immediately. And by that, you've got to have a system and a process in place if you're going to be effective.
Madam Chair, if I could add to that
Mr.
point.
Mr. Creamer.
I think it is also important to be clear that nothing in the proposal or in the system that we now have would preclude a school, a priority school, from firing a principal this summer when they're identified, or from firing teachers if they feel that they're ineffective. That is, again, the idea here is to give more flexibility to districts and schools to determine what is the best path. In the example that Deputy Commissioner Montano used, it may not be in greater Minnesota that it makes sense to immediately fire the principal and fire half the teachers. In a school in urban, in the metro area, that might make more sense. That's something that would be determined at the district level in consultation with the Department of Education and the statewide system of support. But I think it is important to know that nothing would preclude the very process that you are describing from taking place if it is, in fact, the right process for the school that's been identified.
Thank you, Mr. Creamer. Representative Myra.
Excuse me for having my back to you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Creamer, I have a school that's two blocks from me that has failed AYP for 2 years, and another one, a grade school, that's six blocks from me that has failed AYP for 5 years. I find that in my neighborhood, people don't understand the terminology of AYP, Title I. What methodology are you going to use to communicate to the public how their school is doing by adding MMR, focus, and priority?
Mr. Creamer.
Madam Chair, Representative Meyer, that's a very good question and a really important one, because we know that parent and community engagement is, if not the most important thing, one of the most important things in these schools and for all schools. So with the priority and focus schools specifically and the continuous improvement schools, there is a requirement that they, there's a parent notification requirement. Parents are, schools that are identified as priority and focus schools will annually have to send a letter home to parents directly through the mail, not bringing it home with the student where it may or may not get to the parents, but we'll have to send it directly to parents explaining the status of the school, explaining the performance of the school that led to that status, and then explaining what's happening next. And perhaps most importantly, also has to set out concrete ways in which the parents and the communities can engage in the process of turning the school around. So it has to create, you know, times and places where parents can get involved and be a part of that turnaround process. For continuous improvement schools, the requirement would be that they send out a letter, again, explaining their status, explaining how they got there, and offering opportunities for parents to be involved. So those three low-performing groups that we have, those parent notification letters and that parent engagement process is going to be critical to that process of turnaround. For all schools with the multiple measurements rating, we're really excited because this really coincides well with what we have in our new website. The data center on our website allows parents to be much more focused in the way that they look at data. You can look at specific types of data in a much more understandable, clear way now with the website and our data center. We think that the opportunity to use that data center to present this data in a way that's, you know, digestible, I guess, for parents is really important. But we also think that it's really important in these coming weeks and months that we continue to get the message out to parents, to communities, to teachers and principals. Prior to the waiver being approved, the commissioner and staff were on sort of a statewide tour doing questions and answers in districts and in communities. That's going to start up again relatively soon. We're also going to be having online materials. We've already posted a number of online materials in the weeks since the approval on our dedicated page for the No Child Left Behind waiver. We're going to be doing the best that we can to really inform people on this, because your point about AYP is very well taken. As the person who took most of the calls from parents and from principals and teachers about AYP, I would say that the rate of literacy on AYP was quite low. And I think it was confusing for a lot of people. I think that that was in part the product of a feeling from the beginning that there wasn't a great deal of legitimacy in the rating itself, but also in the fact that there wasn't necessarily the concentrated effort to educate parents and community members on this. This is a real good opportunity for us as a department and as a state to kind of refocus that, start from scratch and say, here's where we are, here's what we're going to be using to measure schools, and here's what it means for you and your students.
Madam Chair, may I add one comment to that?
Ms. Montano.
Also, if you look at our latest org chart, there isn't a part in there that's got parent engagement. That's one of the commissioner's major initiatives. So right now we're looking at seeking funds to do a lot with parent engagement. We've got a couple of pilot initiatives going on right now in how to best engage parents. And so that's one of our major initiatives and major focus, because we know that that is critical and it's important and it's been lacking.
Madam Chair, may I have a follow-up? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kramer, unrelated. We're talking about Title I schools. What is the total number of schools that, and how many will not be a part of the reward, celebration, and all the other categories?
Yeah. Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Myra, I believe we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 schools in the state. 840 of which, or 845 of which, received Title I funds. The system under AYP was the same, where 1,200 schools essentially are left out of the system. They get their MMR and their AYP, just as they have before, again, with new data now with MMR. But they're not going to fall into the priority, focus, reward, continuous improvement group. Of the 842, or 845, whatever it is, Title I schools, somewhere in the neighborhood of, it's 50% of the Title I schools will fall into one of those categories, which is roughly the equivalent of what we've had under AYP, with 50% of schools falling into an AYP stage. It's gone slightly over that as the targets have gone up in the last few years, but we're looking at 2,000 schools, 840 some Title I schools, and then 420 roughly schools that fall into one of the five categories that we've outlined today.
Thank you.
Ms. Montano?
Oh, I'm sorry, I was just mentioning to him to remember that there are more schools that are eligible, that are actually Title I schools. There's just not enough funding. So there's only enough funding to get to the 840 to 45.
Representative Myra, follow up. Okay. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm focusing on the chart behind you, and we've had a similar situation in healthcare, and here's my concern with it. When you go by percent and you target the top percent for one thing and the bottom percent for another, and there isn't much variation, and I know there will be at the beginning, but as this moves forward, pretty soon your variation from the top to the bottom, if this works, will shrink, and then you are perhaps identifying schools as needing continuous improvement or priority who may not have a significant, statistically significant difference from someone just above them. And so I'm wondering, when you use the identified as a percentage, if you're not, at some point, that's not going to be a problem.
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, that's a very good point. Part of the, I would first say that the percentages of priority and focus schools and setting a percentage of reward schools was a mandate under the waiver guidance. So there wasn't a lot of flexibility there. I would also add that in the short term, at least, it allows us to be more focused in the way that we direct our resources. An illustration of where we're at right now with the current system is that we had, I think, 500 some district and school improvement plans that were submitted to MDE last year. We have two people in the department who are dedicated to reviewing those plans. We'd certainly like to have more, but we don't, and we have to spread our resources around the best we can. So with 500 plans and two people, you can imagine that, you know, as great a work as they do, it's not necessarily the most effective process. By focusing on a set percentage of schools that are the lowest performing, it will allow us to be more effective in the way that we use our people and the way that we use our resources as a state. But going forward, if we get to that day where, you know, that gap really has shrunk, which we all obviously hope that this leads to, it might be an opportunity for us to look at, you know, 3 or 4 years down the line, another type of waiver process, or if there's reauthorization, maybe that would be something that we could review in consultation with some new flexibility from the federal government on that issue.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. I think my question probably is a little bit of a follow-up to Representative Myra's, because it's very kind of down some similar train of thought. But I was very pleased to hear about the parent involvement plans, because it's, you know, no matter what we do, if the parents are not, you know, on board with whatever it is we're trying to accomplish, it's not going to happen in the school. So with regards to the parent involvement, I mean, how detailed are those plans? Will there actually be places for parents to be on committees with teachers and administrators and officials or folks from MDE in implementing the plans and continually part of that process? Or what are your thoughts on that at this point?
Ms. Montano.
Madam Chair, Representative, in the plans, they are required to have a parent committee that's involved from the very beginning in terms of looking at the needs assessments and the data and some of the strengths and weaknesses, and there is an opportunity for parents to be engaged in identifying what are the initiatives that are going to be in place to help strengthen those areas that we find are weak. They've always been there, but when you have this many schools, it's really hard to focus and make sure that's happening. With the flexibility that we have and focusing on fewer schools, that really gives us an opportunity to make sure that parents and communities are engaged. With the initiatives at the department, we're going to make sure that parents are aware that they have this opportunity and it's their responsibility to become involved. And we also want to make sure that school boards are involved and are aware of some of the strengths and weaknesses that are findings. So it isn't only the parents that we want involved. We also want their school boards. And many school board members are parents. So we really want to make sure that entire community gets behind some of the initiatives, because the schools are going to need that. It's not that they're wanting to do things that aren't effective. Many times they're not sure of what to do, and they don't have the support, and they need that support and someone to come along and help with that. And so we're wanting parents and community school boards to be actively engaged and involved in supporting these initiatives and not be punitive.
Representative Liu.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, well, good. I'm very glad, again, to hear that, and I hope certainly that the process, again, allows for as much flexibility and parent involvement as possible. I know we've seen, and again, in some of my own school, some activities where sometimes the parent involvement is perceived by the public as being a few parents handpicked to ensure certain results, and I'm certainly not suggesting that's the case here, but again, we all know how important that is. The second question I had was with regards to timelines, and I think, Mr. Kramer, you mentioned that, you know, under the old or the SIG schools that, you know, the timeline kind of stretched out and we weren't seeing results. So what is the plan for, especially in the priority schools with the turnaround plans? At one point will we say, you know, we've tried this avenue and it's not getting the results we hope, so we need to move in a different direction?
Madam
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Loon, in the application we've outlined a process wherein after the three-year period, if a priority school, essentially in 3 years, we'll do this all over again. We'll identify new priority and focus schools. If a priority school is identified as a priority school again in 3 years, then the options that on the table become much more limited. It's a type of restructuring or closing up of the school that we've had under No Child Left Behind. We're very optimistic that that won't take place. We think that with the kind of support that we can provide to these groups of schools and the types of things we're going to put in place, that they will, you know, certainly get out of that bottom 5%. But in the event that there isn't a meaningful type of implementation of these plans and we're still at the same place in 3 years, again, we have built in the opportunity to look at restructuring and changing the school altogether.
Representative Balloon.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just final comment. All right, so, you know, the information and the designations will come out in May, as I understand it, and you will strive to have those plans in place by the fall school year. So we're looking at three school years from starting this fall for looking at those results.
Mr.
Correct?
Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Loon, that's correct. Year one would be next school year, 2012-13. And we're glad that, you know, one of the benefits of us getting approved early, being one of the first 10 states, is that we'll release these groups early, and they'll have a much longer lead time into next year where they can make some meaningful plans and changes going into next year rather than having a month or 2 months, depending on what the Department of Education's process would have been for the schools or the states that applied later.
So, Mr. Kramer, are your data systems all in place? I know that you collect enormous amounts of data on all of our schools, but are your data systems in place? And considering that you can study all this data now before you launch in the fall when the school year begins, don't you think that some schools that are going to be priority are going to need a major restructuring? Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, as to the data component, yes, our data systems are ready to go. We've been measuring growth previously, so we're good to go there. Making some adjustments to the way that works to get the achievement gap reduction score measured, and obviously some adjustments to the way we look at AYP. But we should not have any issues from a data perspective internally. I'm not sure if I completely understood your question, but if it's referring to the needs of schools, priority schools, for example, to build their own capacity.
Correct.
To deal with this type of
yes.
data, that's the type of technical assistance and support that is really crucial at the regional level. Again, I mentioned the regional service co-ops and the model that we're moving to now with regional centers of excellence. That's having those people on the ground in the community, being able to be there on a day-to-day basis and consult on, you know, what does this data mean, is something that's going to be really important. We've also talked to some external groups. Dr. Heistad from Minneapolis has a group that works on a lot of data issues, and he is offered to be involved, and we'll be pursuing, looking at whether relationships like that would be fruitful going forward for these priority schools as well.
And it makes me think of school leaders like Eric Mahmoud, who has, you know, turned around a school, and really that was, maybe it wasn't what you would call a restructuring, but I would think of it more or less as a restructuring and having a high poverty group of students, very low achieving, And I would hope that Eric Mahmood and others who are great school leaders, whether they're in charter or public, could be your resources as these struggling priority schools look to ways to, as I would say, restructure and hopefully begin the 12-13 school year ready to go with a new system in place, because this is going to be an insurmountable task for them to take on. And they need those role models out there and those leaders who have shown that we can achieve regardless of poverty level, regardless of achievement level. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the testimony today letting us know about the waiver process and the what you guys would like to do to improve education in Minnesota. I'm reading this over. I'm looking at your chart here, hearing your testimony. And this probably, is it fair to say this is a really big deal, right?
Oh, yes.
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, we would classify it as a very big deal.
Mr. Kramer, yes, it is huge.
Very exciting.
And so in looking at that and just trying to understand, you know, where we were and where we are and how we got there, looking at the waiver process and really the law, first of all, No Child Left Behind, and how that came about through a president and a Congress agreeing on a way to improve education, some of which was good, some not so good. But it is a law passed through Congress and signed by the president, and now we have a waiver process. Do you know, and maybe this is an unfair question for both of you, but how does the waiver process work through the Congress and through the State House and Senate as a way to work collaboratively to help our kids? And I'm thinking of it from a local perspective, as we have school boards and principals and so forth, understanding what is asked of them and who is asking. And you know, in one way we pass laws here, we governor signs them. In other ways we have a waiver process. So explain how the Congress and how the state legislature is involved in helping to improve education in this manner.
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett. From the federal perspective, I think it's really important to that we make it known that everything that we've proposed in the waiver that's now been approved by the Department of Education, if you were to look at, for example, Representative Klein's bill on ESEA reauthorization that was released last week on the same day, actually, as the waiver announcement, as well as the Senate bill that has passed through committee on a bipartisan basis, everything that's in those bills would be consistent with what we have proposed here. We didn't want to end up coming back here in 2 years when ESEA gets reauthorized and completely scrap this and start over. We're confident that if the conversation continues in the direction it's going in Washington, that the system that we have here would be able to be maintained, perhaps even improved upon slightly, with a bit more flexibility from the new ESEA. As for the involvement of the state legislature, I don't think you can quantify just the importance of the work that the legislature has done over the past several years and how it led to this. Whether we're talking about principal and teacher evaluation, which was a primary component of the waiver proposal and a requirement in order to get it, we were in a position where we could apply for this because the legislature and the governor passed that last year. Similarly, our ability to measure growth was based off of legislation that has come out of this body and been signed by governors previously. Our state standards, which are college and career ready aligned, which puts us ahead of many states that would like to apply for this waiver, again, passed through the legislature and signed by the governor. So what we've done here is taken the many tools that have been provided over the years by the legislature and the governor and put into statute, and we've found ways to use those tools in a way that more effectively manages the accountability system that's mandated by the federal government and that the Department of Education is charged with enforcing here in Minnesota.
Representative Barrett, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the waiver again, how long is the waiver? Is it 2 years only?
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, yes, it's a two-year waiver with a third year added. You can apply for an extension for a third year. The expectation is that most states, as long as they are fulfilling the requirements that they've agreed to under the waiver, would get that third year of extension. It is trumped by any reauthorization. So if the skies part and Congress passes an ESEA reauthorization in the next few months here and President Obama signs it, that would take precedence over the waiver. We certainly hope for that because we think that teachers and principals need that long-term commitment to what we're doing. So if that happens, that would be great. If it happens a year from now or 2 years from now, that would be great too, and that would take precedence over what we've done here at the waiver.
And then one follow-up, if
Representative Barrett.
Sure. Regarding the waiver and the process and the two-year time frame, some of the mandates in this waiver don't take effect until after the waiver period has ended, which seems like, again, from a local perspective, wondering what's happening and which way the wind is blowing today, it seems like it would be a conflict and a potential issue for implementation of a lot of this stuff.
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett. I believe the only thing that wouldn't have taken effect until the waiver is expired would be the principal and teacher evaluation systems. As for the accountability measurements, those are effective essentially immediately. The day that we were approved last week, the financial set aside, the mandates were lifted, the flexibility was given, and the requirements that we've established under the waiver for the way that schools operate went into effect. The principal and teacher evaluation system, again, was a promise that was made in the waiver that we would continue to follow the legislation that was passed. It wasn't a restructuring of that legislation. It wasn't a reinterpretation of that legislation. It was simply a description of that legislation and the process that we're going through as a state to work with stakeholders to develop those systems and then put the systems into place with a pilot in 13-14 and a full statewide system in 14-15.
Mr. Kramer, as long as you made that point, as I read 164, I see you as much more of a compliance group when it comes to the principal and teacher evaluation models. Is your intention to be more of a controller when it comes to locally designed teacher evaluation and principal evaluation? As I read it here, it seems to be very heavy-handed from the department.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, just to reiterate, nothing in the waiver application would take precedence over what's in statute at the state level. If there's language in there that you're interpreting as overreach by the Department of Education, I can't speak to that specifically. I know that there was certainly no intent to use the waiver for the department to take more of a role in the implementation or compliance with the principal and teacher evaluation systems. It could very well be that it's just a matter of poorly chosen language in that particular passage that you're looking at.
But Madam Chair, if I could add to
Ms.
that,
Bentanya.
I think there are certain components that you, the legislature, would like to see in these models. So I think our only role here is just to make sure that those components are included in whatever system they choose to use. And I think that's one of the roles that I think was the intent, is that whatever they have choices. And we will develop a model with the components that I think you would like to see in there. And districts can certainly develop their own models. But those components, however they might see them, I would assume that you would like to make sure that they're there. I think that would be our only role, not so much as a compliance.
Representative Breinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is directed toward Mr. Kramer, and it piggybacks a bit on Representative Norton's question. And I want to just do a little bit of discussion before I actually ask the question, but my concern is around the internal evaluation process that the department might have in place in relation to the metric that we put in place here with this MMR, and that's we've assigned equal weight to four different measures. And there's been no discussion of what the statistical justification might be for that equal weight to those four different measures. But nevertheless, I'm assuming that there's some perspective on an overview of how that presumed relationship might move forward. And a little background on that, when the growth model was developed, one of the agreements we had with the assessment and measurement professionals that were involved in that is the metric needed to be reviewed after 2 years to understand if it was performing as expected There was a professional assumption that it would do so, but there was no guarantee that the data would actually predict what it is and perform in the manner we thought it would. And I think we have the same responsibility here, especially with a more complicated metric, to ask whether the data is performing as expected. Otherwise, the model becomes static, and we're not learning from its application. So I'm asking what provision the department might have made for that range of issues.
Excellent question, Representative Breinert. Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Breinert, first to speak to the weighting issue, the equal weighting issue. That was a topic that was thoroughly discussed in the stakeholders group, which included several district assessment coordinators and people who are experts in this field. And the general consensus, I won't say it was unanimous because I know there were folks that perhaps would have chosen a different route on the weighting, but the consensus among most members was that equal weighting made the most sense from a communication standpoint at first, to make it easier for, again, districts and principals, teachers, parents to digest. So that was the intent there. As for revisiting and reviewing this, that is absolutely something that we will continue to do. Under No Child Left Behind with AYP, there wasn't really a provision to do that. We had AYP. We had to keep working with it. Because this is a more flexible system, if there comes a time where we see that the weighting needs a change or that a particular measurement needs to be adjusted, there would be an opportunity to do that. I think if you've, for those of us who have worked with superintendents and district assessment coordinators, we know that we're not going to be left to just do this on our own without being checked on it. I think in the next couple of years, we'll have a lot of discussion with those folks about the effectiveness of this measurement and looking at, from a technical standpoint, is it sound? From an educational research standpoint, is it sound? And is it getting the kind of results that we want to be getting?
Representative Breinert, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That helps me reassure me to some level, but I would still hope that I know that capacity in the department is an issue, but I would hope we'd be proactive and ahead of the game in constantly looking at the model as it's rolling out and seeing what the data is telling us and whether it's speaking the language we thought it was going to speak and whether there's tweaks in order before we get to that two-year review point, so that we're pretty, just as I said, proactive. So I would just encourage that approach and maybe would like to seek some further discussion on that issue.
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Breinert, I think it's important to note that we do have a stakeholders committee on assessment that exists in continuity. The assessment, I don't know their exact act, it's like the ACLAC or something like that is the acronym for this group. And it's a group of esteemed professionals in the field. We also have our TAC, our Technical Advisory Committee, which is both a national and a local unit. We will be working with them on all of this as we go forward. I think our psychometricians and statisticians within the department who work on this assessment data are really excited, not just about this opportunity to do something new, but to really dig into it, see what it means, and see the kind of data that we're getting out of it. And we believe they're up for that challenge of reviewing it and working with the experts out in the field to ensure that we're getting the kind of results we want.
Ms. Montano.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would be remiss as my role of deputy commissioner if I didn't make this point. I heard a comment the other day, a word used the other day. It's called drip, and I'm like, what the heck is drip? Well, it's data-rich, information-poor, and that's what we are. However, we're so thinly stretched in the department, we don't have the staff that can actually look at evaluation and research components and figure out what it is that we're doing that's really effective and working. Now, I'm looking for resources. They're not in the agency right now, I can tell you that. But anything you can do to help us. I mean, we've got lots of information. We should be doing a lot more with that information in terms of looking at this information in such a way that gives us a lot more with respect to what is successful and what is not. 60% of us is federally funded. We're thinly stretched, and I agree, we are data-rich, information-poor, and that's one of our priorities, and I'm looking, I'm not finding a lot under those rocks.
Representative Breiner, did you have further?
Thank you.
Representative Peterson, Sandra. Representative Breiner, did you have further?
Thank you.
Representative Peterson, Sandra.
There you are. Sorry. Good to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And really, mine is a follow-up, I guess, on the resources. And you may have, maybe I missed it, but I'm curious about how the money's going to flow. Is there going to be a change in the way that the federal government sends the money to schools and to the department? And as I look at this, and you talk about just a certain percentage of the schools being those that will get the intensive help, are the other schools that are Title I still going to get the resources that they need to continue to be improving? And that's part of the question. And who is going to make those determinations? Is that the department? And as a follow-up, the last one, I guess, is you're talking about service units providing the professional development, and will you be then providing resources for the coaches and the mentors and all of those groups that you've talked about to help develop the professional development? Just some of the questions about the money that I might have missed.
Ms. Montano.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, the funding formulas are not changing.
Yeah.
Title I funds, Title II, Title III, they'll all be distributed using the same formula that has always been used. So none of that is changing. Whether a school is identified as a priority or a focus or a reward, if they're eligible for Title I funds and the formula at the district level has sufficient funding to give to that school, they will continue to receive the same amount of Title I funds as they've always received. So that is not changing. What is changing is the ability to use some of those funds, particularly in the priority and focus goals, a little bit differently. I believe Mr. Kramer mentioned the 20% set aside that if districts or schools chose to continue with the SES and choice, they can do so. They can also take that 20% set aside, and in some cases it's a lot of money, and choose to use it differently. If you've got schools that are identified as priority and focus and they're also qualified for low income or small rural of districts, previously those funds were required to be used for school improvement. They now can use those funds for other initiatives within the Title I regs. So there's more flexibility, but the formula isn't going to change. With respect to your question on the regionals, what we're calling centers of excellence, as I indicated, we're information or data-rich, information poor. One of the things we're going to focus on these centers is looking at consistent approaches so that we have data and information so that we can see what is working and what isn't working. But within that consistent framework, there's the flexibility to target those schools with respect to their unique needs. They will be. We will be looking at funneling some of the SIG grant funding and the school improvement money towards those centers to hire coaches, reading specialists, math specialists, mentors. It depends on what is needed in that area. We're not going to say every single one of them is going to look differently because one size doesn't fit all. We're going to look at those centers in terms of what's needed, and some of those resources will be channeled to those areas. And make sure that they have the staff necessary to provide the service.
Thank you.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kramer, I agree with Representative Barrett. This is a big deal. So I appreciate you coming and explaining it to us. It's a pretty thick packet here, so I appreciate the summary. I think the goal, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday in Education Finance, of a 50% decrease in the achievement gap is a very honorable goal. But I think we've had goals like that before, and you've laid out a plan here, and so I think it's a good plan. I think, you know, it's got good intentions, it's got all the right elements to make it work, but I think we've done that before and thought we would get the same result. My question is, by 2015, if we have not done that, then what is the ramifications of that? Beyond, obviously, the achievement gap ramifications are pretty severe already. But what other options do we have at that point? At what point are we saying that maybe we don't have the answer and we need to do something completely differently?
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Woodard, as for the achievement gap and, you know, our ability to achieve that goal, I would in some ways dispute that we've put the resources toward that, at least under No Child Left Behind before. I know there have been state initiatives on that, and they've been effective in some cases, not so much in others, but with No Child Left Behind, with the identification of focus schools, with a new measurement that measures the ability of schools to close the achievement gap. Those are new and we think fairly innovative ideas that are going, we are optimistic will help close the achievement gap. But your point is well taken that, you know, it's a big goal, it's a tough goal, and it's going to be really difficult to get there. And my answer to that would just be that the beauty of what we've got here is that because we have new flexibility, especially in school improvement planning, is that if we're doing things that aren't working, we can stop doing them. We've been doing things that haven't been working under No Child Left Behind now for 10 years. We weren't allowed to stop doing them. Now we are allowed to learn from our mistakes and grow from there. I believe that this opportunity will allow us to be more responsive to failure when it does take place. And we're optimistic that because we have that flexibility, that will lead to better results. As far as consequences, I think as you sort of alluded to, the real consequences is what happens to the kids. You know, we want to, and in the schools, it's there are no, the federal government doesn't come in and take over the school if we don't start closing that achievement gap. They don't come take over the Department of Education. There are no federal consequences for not meeting that goal. Other than, again, that it's, as you said, a noble goal that if we don't meet, we're going to have numerous other social problems and education problems that result from it.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of follow-ups here. I would say that a federal takeover of the Department of Education may have already occurred with 60% of your funding coming from the federal government, but that's probably a topic for another for another hearing. You know, you mentioned, and I thought you had a pretty good analogy of, you know, the starting point that some kids have in Minnesota, and that's kind of the good example of the achievement gap or a good description of it. And this may be an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why is it that some of our kids are 20 yards behind?
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Woodard, I wish I could begin to be the person to answer that question. You know, we have a lot of really smart people in education, teachers and specialists and principals and superintendents who are working on that day to day. The factors that we see because of where the achievement gap comes from is poverty is a major major component of that. The research has shown that the achievement gap for poverty is growing. And we have more students in poverty. In Minnesota, we have an increasingly diverse population, which is leading to more of an achievement gap. You have students coming from different countries, speaking different languages, and as we become more diverse, that creates new challenges for schools. But as for the roots of the problem, there are people far smarter than me that are still trying to figure that one out, so I'm not even going to begin to try to assess exactly where it's all coming from.
Well, Representative Woodard, I think we can be encouraged because there are models across this nation that show we can change this, and that's what we have to focus on. I feel such a sense of urgency that we have to move on day one of this coming school year with these children who are behind, and I don't want planning to be going on forever. I want action. Representative Woodard, I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's exactly the right comment. My final question really has to do with the resource issue. This is a big plan, and you mentioned, Ms. Montoya, that you know this is obviously you feel that your resource stretched. Is this going to cause additional strains on that? And then I'll also just kind of mention that I am sympathetic. I did have a bill last year, the Opportunity Scholarship Bill, that would have added an FTE to the Department of Education that might have been helpful, but we didn't get that one. Pass the governor.
Ms. Bentani.
Madam Chair, Representative Woodard, try again. Give us more than one. In response to your question, though, the Title I funds and the Title II funds and the Title III funds that we receive will be channeled towards these efforts. And because we're going to have fewer schools to work with, those resources will be maximized, as opposed to having to work with 500 schools. And by 2014, I think we're going to be up to 800 schools if we didn't make some changes. Those resources will be channeled towards fewer schools. So in that respect, I think we're going to be okay, and we're hoping that what we learn from that will be then transferred, you know, to the other schools that aren't going to receive the intense services that these are going to receive.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Montoya.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to echo Chair Erickson's first comments. I believe you put a fantastic presentation together, and you laid this out very well, so we certainly appreciate that. And also appreciate, Mr. Kramer, your response to one of the questions of on the waiver itself. Is one of the reasons we achieved that or received that is because of the efforts that we've done over the last couple of years in response to accountability and evaluation. So I think it has been a joint effort. And there certainly has been apprehension, which there always is with change. But I would be remiss if I didn't do my duty sitting on the Finance Committee to ask more questions about these resources, because we now have, I think you alluded to two people working through 500 applications. We now have a new MMR rating, a lot of work to be done there. We also have some newly formed the MDE implementation team, I think we have a cross-agency team. I'm just wondering if you could speak more to how is this being done, what is the funding mechanisms for there. The report also suggests that we'd be looking for more in-state funds and even private resources. So really would like a little more detail on how you expect to get this done and what you may be asking for in the future.
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, if you
don't mind, I'm sorry, Ms. Montano.
I will take that question. Representative Kelly, Madam Chair, in terms of maximizing the resources, again, as I indicated, we're going to be working with less schools, so those resources can be maximized. Under ESEA, No Child Left Behind, the reauthorized title, we're going to focus the Title I resources, the Title II, which is principal and teacher effectiveness, as well as the Title III funds, which are for ELL students, towards the efforts in the priority and focus schools. So we're going to maximize. Also in the department, we've aligned a lot of initiatives. The Title I staff are going to be working hand-in-hand with the school improvement staff so that the Title I funding is supportive of the school improvement initiatives. Prior to this, they worked in silos. We're also looking at aligning and making it easier for districts to put together plans. So right now we're looking at Title I, Title II, Title III, QCOM, professional development, and looking at all the components in there that are consistent and the same. And we're working towards putting together a plan that districts can then put together so they see the big picture. What we still see are silos. You got your Title I group here, your Title Group II here, and your QCOM group here, and your professional development. So we're looking at bringing all those pieces together and allowing a district to put together a plan, which then allows them to put the various components and resources in place to support a systemic approach to improvement. In terms of the centers, we're using the under Title I, we're allowed to take 4% off the top for school improvement. We're going to channel some of those resources to these centers. We're also going to look at the funding that we receive separately under the SIG school improvement grants, channel to those centers. However, again, because they are specific to those initiatives, they will only be serving those schools. Our hope is that we can find other resources through foundations or if the legislature sees fit to add to those centers and really focus around providing consistent services to those schools with the data and information that's going to allow us to answer some of your questions in terms of what is effective and what isn't, and using our data more effectively. With respect to the two people in the agency who were reading 500 applications, we're going to look at sending some of those initiatives to the centers and perhaps take these two people and utilize them differently so that it's more effective since we are looking at a smaller number of schools.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Ms. Montano. In regards to the newly formed teams, the implementation team or the cross-agency team, are these current employees? Are we going out and needing new employees? Where are these people coming from?
Ms. Montano.
Representative Kelly, Madam Chair, they're all current employees, okay. And they're all federally funded.
Okay.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we're talking about, maybe it's overused, this public-private partnership, and you talk about private resources, do you have an idea of what that means, and do we have revenue streams that we have not been able to utilize before or attract? Is that something that the plan accounts for?
Ms. Montano.
Representative Kelly, Madam Chair, in terms of revenue streams within the agency, we have looked at all the flexibility that there is, and right now I think we've maxed whatever flexibility there is with federal dollars. State dollars support like content specialists, Mr. Melcher's team. So state dollars are focused on specifically those kinds of initiatives, and federal dollars are supporting like special ed, even some of the charter school staff. So we have looked internally at where what we've got. In terms of externally, we continue to look to see where we can, you know, foster partnerships, and we'll continue to do so.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Just one final question. Then we believe as a department with the current state funding that you're able to accomplish what you're doing with the budget that we've laid out.
Ms. Montano.
Representative Kelly, Madam Chair. We're using federal funds, and so only those schools that are receiving the Title I funds are going to receive these services.
That's
we're
right.
going to have a lot more schools yep. that are going to be identified that are not going to be eligible or able to receive any of these support services. They're on their own.
Representative Depke.
I think Representative Tim Kelly has asked many of my questions, but I we're getting to the crux because I can't get my head out of the numbers. I'm sorry, I'm on education policy, but education finance is still in my brain. I can you give us an estimate, because I think this is very important as we go forward, particularly because of the economy that we're in and what we're facing as a state and what we're doing with education this year. I'd really like to know some kind of an estimate of how much more state funding you're going to need above and beyond the federal funding to implement this program and to hire the full-time employees that you need, because this is a huge undertaking, and I'm very much aware that you're concerned for your staff being stretched and so forth, but I think we need an estimate from you as to how much more money we're going to need at the state level for this program.
Ms. Montano.
Madam Chair, to implement the waiver, we're doing it. We're doing it with the resources we have right now, and they're all federal. If we're talking about, and I think Mr. Kramer indicated that we have over 2,000 schools and only 800 of them are getting Title I money, so you're talking the remaining schools, I will gladly give you some estimates of what it would take to take these services and expand them to make sure that the other 1,200 or however many schools we have would also be entitled to some of these services.
Thank you very much, Ms. Montano, and again, I appreciate all of the, you know, certainly the pressure your staff has been under the last couple of months to implement this request and this waiver, and I'm not trying to be difficult here. I just want some answers. The other thing is that your plan requires a 20% set aside, as you indicated, for the funds. Can you give us an idea what the average amount this equates to, either on a per pupil basis or on a per school estimate on a per school basis, and what's the impact for that particular school on this 20% set aside?
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Depke, that's going to vary hugely from school to school based off the size of the school and the size of the Title I application, which again is based off of poverty levels. So there may be schools where that approaches, I think Deputy Commissioner Montano just said to me, $1 million. In other schools, it's not going to come even close to that. It's going to be a couple thousand, if that. It's going to depend, again, on the size of the school, the amount of poverty in the school. The 20% set-aside, I think, that we have in place is certainly not going to be the extent of the funds of federal funds that schools that are identified as priority and focus schools are dedicating to this process. Most of their Title I funds are going to be dedicated to this process, because the process of improving and addressing these issues is what Title I funding is for. The 20% set aside is in place to ensure that at least in the planning at the beginning of the year, that a priority and a focus school is aligning their budget priorities with that school improvement plan that they're putting together. Now, that funding is going to go above and beyond 20% in all likelihood, because we're just talking about 20% of their Title I allocation, not 20% of the whole school budget. But as for that 20% set aside, we're talking about making sure that there is an alignment between the budget priorities in their Title I application and that school improvement plan that they've put together.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up question.
Representative.
I do understand that the schools are different sizes and it affects each school differently, but surely you have, with all of the analysis that you've done, that you can give us an average or a mean amount in there of how this is going to impact these schools on an aggregate level per pupil. I would like to know that, or per school. Do you have that information?
Ms. Montagna,
can you get that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we can certainly do that. The per pupil amount is based on a formula that is in statute, and it's based on, excuse me, but I'm going to give you a little more than you want. The formula from the federal to the state to the district, is based on census data. Once the money gets to the district, they use free and reduced lunch data. That's how they distribute funding to the schools. So you take the number of free and reduced lunch children, and you multiply or you divide that into the amount of funding that you have, and that's the per pupil amount. So it's going to differ for every single district. Therefore, your 20% is going to differ. The per pupil amount is different at every district based on the number of free and reduced lunch children versus the amount of money that you have left to distribute to those schools based on that formula. We can give you some general analysis, but it's going to differ greatly because of the numbers involved.
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Depke, another issue with providing that kind of estimate at this point is that we don't have a list of priority schools at this point, or focus schools. That has to still in development as we're working on the multiple measurements rating. And as that, what the schools that end up landing on those lists will greatly impact the average, because if you have a lot of high poverty, high population schools on the list, you're going to have a much higher average. If it's a lot of greater Minnesota schools that are smaller and maybe have a smaller percentage of poverty, then that average is going to go down considerably. So until we have the list, it's going to be difficult to do that. I'm sure that once the lists are announced in May, we could do some type of analysis and provide that to members if that would be helpful.
Representative Bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, and thank you, Ms. Montagna, okay, and Mr. Kramer, for coming in, and I sure do appreciate the work that you do. You know, an hour and a half ago, I walked out of my classroom that I go to every morning, and I know that I sat down here, and there were probably, when I first sat down, I think there were 5 teachers. I think so. So someday maybe the teachers will outnumber the lawyers who get elected. Mr. Kramer, you said a great thing, you respond to failure, and that's what as classroom teachers, that's what we do every day. And I watch how we respond, and we respond very quickly. I think they have at Myanmar, at the Air Force center site there, they have a sign up, and I used to bring it up with my wrestlers a lot, but now I bring it up with my students, and the sign says, think fast, fail fast, adjust fast. And in a cockpit, you have to do that, obviously. And that's what I see as the teacher is kind of the individual who's flying that plane, if you will, and we have to adjust really quickly, because there are things, you know, there are questions that come up and items that maybe students or multiple students or even a whole class just maybe misses, or and we have to do that with them. So, and I see the, and you know, being here for a short period of time, I see all that goes on, and then I see what goes on in my classroom and other classrooms, and I talk to other teachers, and I guess I'm just wondering, you know, if you could just bring to me as a classroom teacher the 3 things, or if you wanted to highlight what is the value added to me in terms of going through this. I know I understand the value here, and I understand the data, and how do we, and this is just a huge question, but how do we as the people, you know, planning the structure and using the data, and how do we make sure that we're balancing, you know, the funds and resources that go into our schools? Because in my classroom, you know, and a lot of teachers would tell you, just give me a few less kids, you know, and we could probably do some great things. You know, a lot of teachers would say that, many teachers, or technology or things of that nature. And I sure do understand as a classroom teacher the value of great administrators, great management, and as an econ teacher and Representative Cathy right there with me, I think, is that we understand that managerial ability has a lot to do with economies of scale and our overall productive capacity. But so just tell me, you know, just three things that I can take away, go back, walk into school tomorrow morning and mention to some of the people that I work with, three things value added that you guys are working on with this program.
Mr. Kramer.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Bills. All right, three things. Let's see. You know, I think the first thing, and this is what we've heard in the weeks since and in the time leading up, first thing is that teachers and principals feel like the measurements under No Child Left Behind were not fair and that they weren't valid. We believe we've put into place a measurement system that's a lot fairer and has a lot more value in terms of measuring school performance. Secondary to that, as kind of the second point, I would say that it is, we hope this created less pressure on teaching to the test, as we hear so much about. You know, obviously the performance on those tests is still very important, but by measuring growth, by measuring achievement gap reduction, in addition to just, you know, raw proficiency, as we did with AYP, we feel like there might be a feeling of relief that you can focus on the arts, focus on social studies, focus on science. And then third, we're very hopeful that through this system of support that we've created for those schools that are struggling, that you're going to get better support from the state. You're going to get better lessons from us in terms of, as you said, learning from the failures of others or maybe the successes of others. So those would be the three things that we really hope, I guess, are the biggest takeaways. I could give you a list much, much longer if we had more time, but those would be the three biggest things that I hope get into the classroom out of this.
Representative Bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Kramer. And you know, that is wonderful. That's what I wanted to hear. I do see, and there sure is a pushback. There's a great Wall Street Journal article actually a couple of days ago about No Child Left Behind, and the author, and I wish I remembered the name of the author. Great author. Cut right through the politics of it. You know, the right hates it because of this, the left hates it because of that, and she cut right to the chase and said, well, let's take away something good, and that is that a whole lot of data has been mined due to No Child Left Behind, and now how do we use that data? So that's one thing as a teacher that I'm hoping is used if I've been through that, you know, in terms of teaching to a test or the exams as an AP teacher, you know, that the advanced placement exams are coming, and that's where we're geared, and as an old coach, I actually like that because I used to watch my team's opponents. I could watch them, and then I could calculate how are we going to. Well, I understand with the AP exam that 33% of the questions will come from the supply and demand unit, or what have you, or if this team runs belly, we have to be able to defend that. So, you know, those tests do have a value, even though again you can sure see the problems from both the political sides with No Child Left Behind, but which is a whole other thing when you're wrestling in a conference and section with Apple Valley. Because that when that's your test, you know, my goodness, what are you going to do, you know, if you don't know Valley Wrestling? But so I think we can use that data. The other thing is with me as a teacher, then, if we're using, you know, X to the 3 resources to build this structure to help the schools, you know, to do system support, and we have a number of X to the 3, how then can you guarantee me as a teacher that when that system is put in place and some efficiencies are built in, how does that number, that amount, that total in terms of dollar value or what have you, how does that go to X to the 2, X to the 1 eventually and allow more resources to flow into my classroom rather than staying at that managerial level? Does that make sense? So if you could, thank you.
I'm going to call on Representative Kelly because I think he has a request of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just in regards to Representative Depke's question, I think if we're going to receive the priority and focus list, if they could include the 20% set aside on those schools, that would be helpful. And just one other thing on the list, I noticed in the report it said they'd be 8 weeks out, and so that would be sometime in April, and we keep talking about May. When would we anticipate those lists?
Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Representative Kelly, you're correct that it says, I believe it says 8 to 10 weeks or something like that in the application. Since the application was submitted, it's become clear that the work that goes into this in terms of getting it out and getting it right is probably a little bit more than 8 weeks, but perhaps just as importantly, releasing in 8 weeks would put us right in the middle of the assessment window for schools. That's a pretty chaotic and stressful time at schools, and we don't want to interrupt that important period, especially when those assessments then lead to the same measurements that we're going to be releasing. It's just an unnecessary complication at that point. But more than anything, it's just giving us the opportunity. When we're setting these lists for 3 years, we want to make sure they're right. We got to make sure the data is in good shape. So that's the biggest thing, the biggest reason that it's in May. And again, just to be very clear, it is May. That's what we're looking at, and we're going to get more specific with that as we move closer to that time.
Thank you.
Members, if you still have questions, write them down so that at some point Mr. McHenry is always around, and Mr. Cartu, and they can take those back so we can get our answers. But thank you very much, both of you. This was very informative, and we're going to be thinking about you very seriously as you embark on this. Meeting adjourned.